Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. He's one of the most famous men of science in history, whose discoveries and condemnation are known to many. But until now, little has been known of Galileo's private life. That is the subject of our show today in Eileen Dugan's conversation with Davis Obel, author of Galileo's Daughter. But before we meet Davis Obel, let's take a look at an event that occurred this week in history. This week, in 1775, the American statesman and orator Patrick Henry delivered the speech that would assure him fame as one of the greatest figures of the American Revolution. At the Virginia Convention in Richmond, on March 23, 1775, Henry defended his conviction that war was inevitable with fiery words that were immortalized and passed down from generation to generation of Americans. Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. Between 1765 and 1775, Henry was a member of the Virginia House of Burgesses, a member of the Virginia Committee of Correspondence, and a delegate to the Continental Congresses of 1774 and 1775. After war broke out, he helped draft the first constitution for the newly independent state of Virginia and was elected governor of the state three times. Following the Constitutional Convention of 1787, Henry aroused much controversy by leading the movement that opposed ratification of the United States Constitution. Although he lost that battle, his actions did help secure passage of the first 10 amendments to that document, thereafter known as our Bill of Rights. Turning to two items of historical interest in the news, in June 2001, a 370-acre cemetery and memorial garden commemorating the Battle of Chancellorsville will be opened to the public. Fought in May of 1863, this battle between Union and Confederate troops during the Civil War proved to be a decisive battle for General Robert E. Lee, but it came at a heavy price, for Stonewall Jackson was mortally wounded there. No actual combat occurred on the grounds of the Chancellorsville Memorial Garden, but it served as a staging area for the Confederate attack. The cemetery lies about 60 miles north of Richmond, Virginia. Analysis of the bones of a child buried in a Roman cemetery more than 1,500 years ago is the latest archaeological finding that strongly supports the hypothesis that a widespread outbreak of a lethal form of malaria in the 5th century AD probably contributed to the downfall of the Roman Empire. Researchers at the University of Manchester in England were able to isolate residual samples of DNA from the leg bones of a 3-year-old child. The DNA proved to be 98% identical to that in people infected with the most lethal form of malaria. Until recently, the only evidence linking a probable epidemic in 5th century Rome to malaria has been from literary sources. This is Talking History. Interview this week, we delve into the personal life of the Renaissance scientist Galileo Galilei by examining the largely unknown life of his daughter. Here to help us explore this fascinating side of history is Talking History's Eileen Dugan and her guest, Davis Obel.
Ask any school child about Galileo Galilei, and you'll be told about telescopes searching the heavens and cannonballs dropped from the Leaning Tower of Pisa. The life of Galileo is indeed one of the most famous tales of early modern Europe, mixing exciting discovery and perplexing tragedy, culminating in Galileo's condemnation by the Catholic Church for his loyalty to Copernicanism and his death under house arrest. We know the story, we know his discoveries and publications, but what do we know of the man? What were Galileo's own reactions to his tribulations? Joining us today to explore the world of Galileo is Ms. Davis Obel, author of Galileo's Daughter, a historical memoir of science, faith, and love. Welcome, Ms. Obel.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
How did you get interested in this subject?
I have always been interested in Galileo because I was an American school child myself, as you said in your introduction, and of course I'd always heard about him, and he struck me as a wonderfully romantic figure and brave for his time to defend science, even in a difficult climate. And I left it there. But while I was studying longitude for my previous book, I was reading about Galileo's efforts to solve the longitude problem, something I'd never known he'd been involved in. And during those researches, I found a letter to him from his daughter, who was a cloistered nun, and who was writing to him because the clock in her convent was broken, and she was having to fix it. And I was thunderstruck by this whole exchange, that he had children at all, because we tend to think of him as a marble bust and not as a real person. So there he had a family, and he had not only one but two daughters who were nuns. And I thought that certainly might overturn the popular impression of him as irreligious, especially because the letter had a tone of great intimacy. These were people who wrote to each other frequently and could speak very familiarly. So I felt there's something extremely interesting here. And if she could be looked at closely, maybe the rest of her letters read, what would she say about Galileo and about his relationship to the church?
Where did you find these documents?
I was reading a wonderful book called The Pulse of Time by Silvio Bedini, which is a scholarly type book about Galileo's science. And he had translated that piece of her letter into English and put it in his book. Later I found out that although 124 of her letters survived, they really did not exist in a complete translation in any other language. But they are published in Italy. So I started by, and fortunately for me, I had studied Italian in school for no good reason, I might add, until now. So I started with the published version of her letters in Italian, but then I actually went to Florence and saw the originals, which was a great thrill.
What do we have from Galileo's own hand in terms of just day-to-day correspondence?
There's a great body of correspondence. Unfortunately, none of his surviving letters is addressed to any of his children. So no one has really heard the sound of his paternal voice. But he wrote a great deal to his colleagues, friends, neighbors, and he wrote eloquently on the subject of science and religion to the Grand Duchess of Tuscany. So his own feelings on these matters are there for the reading.
So who was this daughter of your title?
She was a highly intelligent, sensitive, devoted young woman who entered a convent of the poor Clares when she was 13 years old, and she took her vows there at age 16, which meant that she would never leave the convent again, and that she devoted her life to prayer, mostly. The poor Clares still exist today, and they are still a cloistered order.
And what name did she take?
She took the name of Maria Celeste, which is really poetic because Galileo had already perfected the telescope during her childhood and had become world famous for his studies of the celestial realms. So I think she did that for him.
And who was her mother?
Her mother was Marina Gamba, a woman about 15 years younger than Galileo, who was his mistress for about 10 or 12 years and was the mother of all three of his children. But the two of them never married for numerous reasons. Of course, only he and she know for sure, but it's clear that she was not of his social standing and would not have made a good wife in an age when marriage was really about social connections and inheritance and not about love.
And how did Maria Celeste, as she came to be known, how did her illegitimacy affect her life?
She might well have gotten married if she had not been illegitimate. But that's hard to say. It was quite common for Italian girls of that period to enter a convent. In fact, about half of them did. So it was hardly an unusual place to be, and especially for a girl from a good family. If you were very poor or from a peasant class and uneducated, you probably could not enter a convent. So although her particular convent was poor and the conditions there were difficult for her, still, it was not altogether a bad place to be.
Why do you think Galileo was especially fond of Maria Celeste?
Because she had such a triumphant spirit, and she was so loving. He clearly comes to depend on her over the course of the correspondence. She changes progressively from a young woman who doesn't think very highly of herself to someone who gives him support and counsel and runs his affairs. Even though she's inside the convent, when he goes to Rome for the trial, she really takes over the management of his household. He designates her as the one to do that.
So how did Galileo get in trouble with the church?
He wrote about the sun-centered model of the universe after laws had been passed to prohibit the teaching of it. And he knew that those laws were in effect, but he had been very friendly with the Pope. When this particular Pope, Urban VIII, was cardinal, he and Galileo were friendly. They were about the same age, and they came from the same city, and were both well-educated men with interests in poetry and science. So they had a long-standing relationship, and Galileo went to him to get special permission to write this book that would really explore the merits of the two rival systems of the universe. And, of course, the Pope told Galileo to make it all sound hypothetical. And Galileo wrote the book. Doesn't really sound hypothetical at all. He makes an impassioned defense of the Copernican system. And the book got published. And, of course, at that period, you couldn't just publish a book the way you can today. Everything went through the church censors and licenses. And they approved it. Outspoken as it was approved. But after it came out, everybody got angry, especially the Pope. And Galileo had to stand trial. And the book was banned for 200 years.
How are Galileo's struggles reflected in his correspondence with his daughter?
She bucks him up. You can always tell when he's in terrible despair because she writes back and repeats his words and then urges the proper behavior on him, which is often prayer. And part of his punishment was to repeat the penitential psalms every week. And she took that over for him. She actually performed that part of his penance for him. And when she died, sadly for him, he outlived her. And the letters that came in from his friends, letters of condolence, all expressed the knowledge that she had been the most important person in his life, and that it was inconceivable that he could bear the loss of such a daughter.
Since Maria Celeste was a nun, didn't she have any qualms about associating with her heretic father?
That was a big question of mine at the beginning, but it becomes clear in the correspondence that she never sees him as a heretic. I mean, these were matters of interpretation, nor do any of the other nuns at the convent see him as a heretic. They believe in his innocence, as do other highly placed members of the church. Galileo had a close friend in the Archbishop of Siena who took him in after the trial and restored him to health. This was never a monolithic case of all religious people being on one side and Galileo and other heretics being on the other. It was not at all clear-cut. And since Galileo himself considered himself a good Catholic all his life, he didn't feel there was any heresy involved in studying the structure of the universe.
What do you think is especially timeless about the story of Galileo and his correspondence with his daughter?
Well, the love between father and daughter, which is really beautifully expressed here, is timeless. Galileo's story has resonance for our time, certainly, and this is why the current Pope took steps to make a public pronouncement about Galileo, and why his name keeps coming up when we hear about school board decisions in Kansas or questions about the future of physics, the future of religion. The relationship between science and religion has been an uneasy one for centuries, which is a shame, because I agree with John Paul II that there is no fundamental reason why they should be at odds, but they should not be telling each other how to conduct their business.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Sobel.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Ms. Dava Sobel, author of Galileo's Daughter, a historical memoir of science, faith, and love.
In the midst of the past presidential election, many voices sounded the alarm that the closely contested race and surrounding controversy would destabilize the American political system. That has not come to pass, but to provide some historical perspective on how the authors of the U.S. Constitution prepared for, and later generations dealt with, such threats is Ira Chernus. Chernus is a professor of religious studies at the University of Colorado.
Whatever happened to Al Gore? The case of the disappearing VP is no great mystery. After Election Day, leading media voices began warning us that a contested election would endanger political stability. The public may not fear instability, but the nation's most influential opinion makers apparently still do. They seem to think that if Gore remains in the news, his very name might keep alive destabilizing questions, so he has been disappeared. Anxiety about political instability is an old story among the U.S. political elite. In 1787, the Federalist Papers warned that, quote, the people were dangerously unstable and easily duped. They were likely to make bad choices when, quote, stimulated by some irregular passion, end quote. The best remedy would be, quote, the interference of some temperate and respectable body of citizens, end quote. They were supposedly the disinterested few who were wise and wealthy enough to put public good ahead of private gain. The Constitutional Convention pitted stability against the people, and stability won. The House could be elected by popular vote, but the Senate would be elected and the federal judiciary appointed by the temperate and respectable elite. The Electoral College, chosen by the elite of each state, would ensure that the president would always be drawn from the temperate and respectable, the guardians of stability. Fear of political chaos gave us a system that can keep the popular vote victor out of the White House. In 1824, Andrew Jackson got the most votes for president, but he looked like a backwoods ruffian compared to the venerable John Quincy Adams, so elite leaders made an electoral bargain to keep Jackson out of the White House. The Hayes-Tilden election of 1876 also pitted democracy against stability. The Republican Hayes, clearly the loser, became the winner when he promised Southern Democrats he would work to reverse the gains blacks had made during Reconstruction. No doubt both the Republicans and the Democrats who cut that deal genuinely feared that black suffrage and black equality would bring instability. Still, white Americans continued to speak of the U.S. and its growing power in words like movement, growth, and progress until the Cold War years. Once the U.S. had reached the peak of its power, peace and stability became our national mantra, as if the two words were synonymous. Justice Scalia and his four colleagues lived through a half-century of Cold War. No doubt they genuinely fear instability. So do the journalists and pundits who demanded Gore's abject concession, praised his gracious exit speech, and then swept him off the stage of history. In fact, there's no good reason to think that open debate and government by majority vote will necessarily breed instability. These fundamentals of democracy may keep our society more stable. But today, just as in the past, no one asks the people whether they prefer stability over democracy. No one even asks the people whether they think electoral democracy threatens stability. The temperate and respectable elite still assume they know the answers. They assume they are preserving stability by making sure that no one asks disturbing questions. Anyone who might provoke destabilizing discussion must disappear, even if he is still the vice president.
You've been listening to Ira Chernus, Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Colorado. Professor Chernus' op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. Following up on our interview on Galileo, we have chosen for our site of the week a place where you can see firsthand some of the inventions and instruments he used to make his scientific discoveries. Here to tell you about the site is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
If you're heading to Florence, Italy, make sure you visit the Institute and Museum of the History of Science. Here you can travel back in time and see the original instruments used by Galileo, including two of the telescopes he constructed, a geometrical and military compass, and the objective lens of the telescope with which he became the first to observe the satellites of Jupiter. And on a bit of an odd note, on display is the index finger from Galileo's right hand. There are also models from the post-Galileo era linked to his early investigations and the changing style of the instruments from works of art to practical mechanical pieces. Can't get to Florence right now? Then try a virtual tour of the Galileo room by visiting the website of the Institute and Museum of the History of Science. And there you will find information and pictures about each of the items in the room at the museum.
Turning to our list of coming attractions, we have two programs to tell you about that air on History Channel during the next few weeks. The Great American History Quiz returns on March 26th. This new version of the popular and challenging test of your knowledge of the nation's past will feature three contestants playing for dollar value points. Round one features video clips or pictures about a famous person, moment, or structure that contestants must identify. The two highest point winners will move on to round two, where they'll be asked questions concerning three people, events, or things, with follow-up questions based on the original right answers. The contestant with the highest score will advance to the final round. He or she will then face a 60-second race against the clock to place current events in the year in which they occurred. Viewers can play along at home via the Internet in real time and have the opportunity to win prizes. The first night of the new version of the Great American History Quiz is Monday, March 26th. For further information, access the History Channel's website. And on April 6th, watch for the premiere of Chicago on the History Channel series Haunted History. The program will unveil the Windy City's surprisingly large number of haunted spirits who rattle their way through the city from the site of St. Valentine's Day Massacre to the Museum of Science. Be sure to check your local listings for exact showtimes of these History Channel programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you'll join us next time. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.